Fine, thank you. Brother Schrade, Reverend Hargett, our many distinguished guests, our friends and fellow trade unionists from General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler plants throughout the world, delegates to the 20th Constitutional Convention, fellow workers and friends. First, I should like to welcome each of you to this convention. I think we are all aware of the fact that we have come together for the purpose of carrying out the high responsibility and the great privilege of representing the 1.5 million members of our union. And during the next 5 days, in keeping with the democratic tradition of our union, in free and full debate, we will be formulating basic programs and policies so that we can meet new problems and realize new opportunities in the period ahead. As Brother Schrade has indicated, this 20th Constitutional Convention coincides with the 30th anniversary of our union. In the last week of April and the first part of May of 1936, a handful of delegates met in South Bend, Indiana, representing less than 10,000 workers throughout the United States and Canada. And at that convention, they laid the groundwork for the building of this great union. And I believe as we look back, we can say that that has been 30 years of progress for people. And during those 30 years, we have written, I believe, some of the most glorious chapters in the history of the American and Canadian labor movements. We dared to join together. We joined to march together, and when needed, we dared to fight and struggle together. And because we did, we have been able to translate many of the dreams that were just dreams 30 years ago into practical and tangible reality. And I believe it can be said in all good conscience, without fear of challenge or contradiction, that no organization, either in the United States or in Canada, has done so much for so many in such a short period of human history as has the UAW. And that record was possible because we dared to work together with courage and compassion, with a high sense of dedication and determination. But the road was not easy that we traveled, because no other union in the whole free world had to face at the bargaining table as many powerful corporations as did the UAW. And they resisted our union with all of the power, with all of the money that they could mobilize. And if they had had their way, this union never would have been born. But we overcame all of that power of these great corporations, and we demonstrated that when free men and women are united in the solidarity of human brotherhood, when they are united by common commitment in pursuit of common objectives, that there is no power in the world that can stop the forward march of free men thus united. Now, in these 30 years, we have not behaved like a narrow economic pressure group that says, give us our little bit more and the public be damned, because we have understood from the very beginning that free labor can solve its basic problems only as it works with men and women in the whole community, finding the answers of the problems of all of the people. And that has been our guiding philosophy. And we have moved forward from one struggle to another. Our industry was a social jungle, and the workers in that jungle were nameless, faceless clock card numbers 30 years ago. They had no rights, they had no protection, and they were the victims of an inhuman speed up. And we revolted against that, and we fought to establish a measure of industrial democracy on the job and a sense of human dignity at the workplace. And we have done that in three basic industries in both the United States and Canada. We have built a structure of industrial democracy in the automotive industry, in the agricultural implement industry, and in the aerospace industries. And I believe that when the history of the UAW is written, that we will be considered among the vanguard of those forces who are engaged in man's eternal struggle to raise the banner of human rights over the welfare of property rights. And I believe that history will record that no other organization fought with such deep conviction to make it clear that people have priority over profits. We have listed here in these two signs some of the things that we've done these 30 years. And I want to tell our membership, and we need always to remind the new fellows who are coming into the plants, who punch their clock, and who get the benefit of these 30 years of struggle. Some of these young workers believe that the General Motors Corporation, that Ford and Chrysler, that North American and Douglas, and International Harvester and Caterpillar served us all these things on a silver platter. And I think we need to tell them that every single item, every single gain that we have made in these 30 years, we got because we had the courage to go out and fight to get them. They gave us nothing on a silver platter. I have said before, we would have been glad to put a listing of those things that we got out of the generosity of the milk of human kindness that overflowed from the corporate hearts of America. But they were so microscopic, we couldn't find a sign small enough to put them on. Because when we asked General Motors and Ford and Chrysler in the last set of negotiations, tell us, what did you really give us? Because you believed the workers were entitled to it. General Motors couldn't answer. Ford didn't respond, and Chrysler said, give us a couple of days to think about it. They had to do some basic research. And on the third day, they said, well, we raised the question of smoking privileges. But that's after we had it in the other parts of the industry. And I remember a couple of years ago when the Chrysler Corporation sold the building on East Jefferson, where they used to house their labor management staff and where the Chrysler negotiations always took place. And this building of the Chrysler Corporation was sold to the Detroit Dental School. And when I read that in the paper, I said, hell, there's no basic change. We've been pulling teeth in that building for years. Now, I think it might be well at this convention to review briefly where we've come from, so the better we'll know where we're going. 30 years ago, the General Motors sit-down strike started in 1936. What were those strikes about? Were they about pensions and vacation pay? Were they about holiday pay, overtime pay? They were about one simple little thing that was fundamental. Those sit-down strikes against the General Motors Corporation 30 years ago were about the right of General Motors workers to sit at the bargaining table and to talk about their problems. We wrote General Motors, and they didn't even dignify our communications by a reply. They filed them in the wastebaskets. And the struggle in the early days was a struggle over the right to be heard at the bargaining table. A couple of weeks ago, our friends in Local 600 had a celebration at the overpass on Miller Road at Gate 4, celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Ford strike that broke the back of Harry Bennett and the gangster control of the Ford Motor Company. We need to let our younger people know what it was like in the early days, how we were beaten up by the gangsters and the underworld goons, and how we were shot at, and how we were intimidated, and how every local union had a high percentage of stool pigeons inside the local spying upon the local membership. But despite all of those obstacles, despite the arrogant power of the most powerful corporations in the world, we moved steadily ahead. And we did that because I believe that the invincible power in this union was that combination of teamwork in the leadership and solidarity in the ranks. And I would like at this point to thank my fellow officers and executive board members in the International Union. I would like to thank the staff members and the local union leadership for the great contribution that they have made in making possible the great progress that we have made. If one were to ask me why we have made so much progress, I would reply that the UAW has done well because we have never forgotten the central purpose of this union. This union is about the membership. It's about the men and women who work in the factories that we have the privilege of representing. Its power and its purpose comes from the membership. And because we have effectively and wisely mobilized that power, we have made great progress. Years ago, if you had said to the delegates at that first convention that we were going to have all the things that we list on these two listings, they would have thought that you were a bit off your rocker. But we have been able in the UAW to constantly probe for new ideas and new concepts, because we have believed that you cannot solve the problems of tomorrow by the tools and the old concepts of yesterday. We learned in the GM strike of 1945 and 46, a strike that went for 113 days, we spent a little more than $1 million in that strike, because we didn't have the kind of strike resources that we now enjoy. And the General Motors Corporation spent $300 million trying to break the strike. But we prevailed. What was the basic demand in that struggle? The basic demand in the General Motors strike of 1945 and 46 was to get a wage increase without a price increase. Because we had learned that if you get a wage increase in one pocket and they take it out in the way of a higher price increase, that you run like the devil, but you stand still and you make no real progress. We didn't win that principle in the 1945-46 strike. We did win an 18.5 cents an hour wage increase. But 1 year later, all of that 18.5 cents an hour was gone because of the erosion of our wage standards, because of inflation. And we went back to the bargaining table in 1948, and we pioneered on two basic new concepts in the labor movement. We nailed down the cost of living index, and we nailed down the annual wage improvement factor. If you go back and read what happened at that time, you will find that there was much criticism of the UAW, both in and outside the American labor movement. Oh, they talked about fancy sliding scales, and they threw all kinds of bricks at your union. But we stayed committed to that cost of living and annual improvement factor. Other unions got it late, but no other union maintained the basic integrity of those two concepts, because we have told the industries that we bargain with that both of these principles, cost of living and the annual wage improvement factor, they are nailed down for keeps in our basic wage structure, and we don't intend to bargain them away as some unions have done in the past. Now, what have these two clauses meant? Since 1948, for a GM worker and other workers who picked it up following the GM contract, well, we got 70 cents in cost of living, and we got 86 cents in improvement factors. And together, that has yielded more than $30,000 to an average GM or Ford or Chrysler worker or any other worker covered. Then in 1949, we decided it was time to break through on the pension front. And we raised the slogan that in 1949, we would not sign a contract with the Ford Motor Company until we nailed down pensions so that workers could have a measure of security and dignity when they were too old to work, but too young to die. And we nailed it down that year. But we did something else that was fundamental. We not only pioneered in the first fully funded pension plan in the mass production industries, but we integrated our pension programs with Social Security. And we did in 2 weeks what America had failed to do in 12 years. We broke the legislative logjam in Washington, and we raised the level of Social Security benefits so that millions and millions and millions of Americans who never paid a penny of dues into the UAW got the benefit of our collective bargaining effort when we tied our pension to the Social Security system. We took this $100 that we got in Ford. We had to fight a 108-day strike in Chrysler to keep it. And then we went to General Motors and we said, now that we've got the principles established, we expect to increase the amount. And we raised the pension to $125. And then we made the rounds again. And we have been building brick by brick on that foundation. In 1955, we pioneered another basic area of collective bargaining. We went in demanding the guaranteed annual wage, and we got the supplementary unemployment benefit plan. This was a historic new breakthrough. It was the first time in the history of collective bargaining in the world where great corporations agreed to begin to accept responsibility for the economic welfare of a wage earner's family during periods of unemployment. General Motors was determined not to go along with the SUB. They had, if you recall, what we called the Wheel of Fortune in 1955. They had mobilized their forces, and they were prepared to take us on. And we said to the General Motors Corporation, do you want to do it the easy way or the hard way? Because one way or the other, we are going to do it. And they finally signed the SUB agreement. and Harry Anderson, the vice president of General Motors Corporation, stood before the television cameras and the newspaper men, and he said, "This is the first time in the history of the General Motors Corporation where the General Motors Corporation is signing an agreement that they are opposed to, that they don't understand." And when it was all over, one of the brothers said to me, he said, "It was a hard fight, but," he said, "we made the SOBs give us the SUB." And that's exactly what we did in 1955. Then we took the SUB and we built upon it the short work week benefits. And in the layoffs that are occurring now because of the imbalance in inventories, thousands of workers will be taking home something approximating 90% of their weekly wage during those short work weeks. Then 2 years ago, we got together in Atlantic City in the 19th Constitutional Convention, and we talked about the 1964 collective bargaining goals. The leadership of your union said, "Give us maximum tactical flexibility so that we can maneuver the collective bargaining process in 1964. And you gave us that flexibility, and it paid off, because the 1964 contracts, I believe, were the most historic contracts in the history of the American labor movement. No other union made so much progress in so many significant areas in one set of bargaining as did we in those 64 negotiations. It wasn't easy. We were confronted, as usual, with a united front on the part of the big three. Oh, they told us they weren't working together, that we were bargaining separately and individually with each company. And yet we experienced what I believe to be the greatest demonstration of mental telepathy in the history of collective bargaining. Because on one morning, within 30 seconds, we got the identical proposition at the Ford, Chrysler, and GM bargaining tables. And we called, as you will recall, special conferences, GM, Ford, and Chrysler workers in Chicago, where the workers in those three councils unanimously rejected the corporation's offer. And I said at that time, in paraphrasing the words of Winston Churchill, I said, "I believe that we could describe the offer of the companies as follows: that never have so few with so much offered so many so little." And we rejected that contract. And at the end of the negotiations, we were able to report that never had so many persuaded so few to part with so much so painfully as we did in 64. That 64 agreement will give GM, Ford, and Chrysler workers and their families more than $2 billion increase in income, not with the wooden nickels of inflation, but $2 billion in real wages during the 3 years of that contract. As you know, we made as the major goal in 64 early retirement. We said that we wanted the older people to get off the line, and we wanted the younger unemployed people to get off the street onto the line. And we broke through on the $400 early retirement benefit. And as we know, we read in U.S. News World Report that a Ford worker from the Rouge plant who came from Sicily 40-some years ago, retired under the UAW agreement, and gets this year in Social Security and retirement benefits, including his wife and his daughter, $7,632. If you had told that to a delegate in South Bend 30 years ago, they would have put you in one of those places where the sidewalls are padded, because no one would have believed that on the 30th anniversary of this union, we would achieve this kind of level of pensions. And yet I want to tell you that we have only made a beginning. We are going to build and build and build upon this foundation until we get the kind of totally adequate pensions that a worker can look forward to, knowing that he can live in security and dignity. More than 10,000 older workers under the early retirement provision retired in the first 4 months in the Big Three alone. That means 10,000 new jobs for young workers. More than 200,000 UAW members are retired. We kept faith with those 200,000 retired workers, and no other union has ever reached back and taken care of all of its retired workers by increasing the level of their pension benefits and providing for them fully paid hospital medical care. But we did something else that I consider to be of great significance in the 64 negotiations. We opened up a kind of benefit upon which we can build further in the future to provide the widow and the survivor adequate protection. That was an area in which we had done too little. And what we did in 64 was an important step in the right direction. Now, we did many other things, but I believe we can have real pride when we look at the success that we had in extending the basic collective bargaining gains that we nailed down in the Big Three to the plants and the ag implement industry, to the parts industry, and then in 1965, we extended them in large measure to the workers in the aerospace industry. Now, this convention will not be charged with the major responsibility of developing a collective bargaining program for 1967, when once again we will be sitting at the bargaining table with the big corporations. We will be calling in the spring of 1967 a special collective bargaining convention that will devote its time exclusively to the formulation of our collective bargaining demands that we will press in 1967. There are, however, two collective bargaining demands that I urge that this convention nail down before we leave Long Beach. I believe that these are the kind of basic collective bargaining demands that we ought to tell the corporations about now, so that they will have an adequate time to make the emotional adjustment. I always think it's unfair to walk into a bargaining session and lay basic demands before the company and give them too little notice. And so if we nail down these two demands now, they won't be able to say that they are still emotionally off balance when we face them in 1967. They'll have plenty of time to search their souls so that they can face us when we meet in 67. And what are these two basic demands? First of all, our union has been talking about abolishing the hourly rate system. This was the goal we raised when we talked about the guaranteed annual wage and we got the SUB. Each contract, we have taken another step, and now the gap between what we have and a guaranteed annual salary is manageable. And I hope that this convention will nail down so that everyone will understand that in 1967, when we sit at the bargaining table, we do not intend to sign a basic agreement accepting as it contains a guaranteed annual salary for the production and maintenance workers of this union. this system of paying workers by the hour, or by the tenth of the hour to be more exact, is historically obsolete, it's economically unsound, and we believe it is morally indefensible. If the corporation executives can pay themselves by the year, then they can pay the workers by the same system. And in 1967, we intend to make this a basic demand. The second demand is also a demand that we need to give them maximum advance notice on.